The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events.
What are we talking about, really? We're talking about propaganda. We're talking about psychology. We're talking about control of the mass mind via big data and AI. Because if you can harness artificial intelligence and big data, if you can control the algorithms, you're on the way to creating 21st century determinism. The question is, what could possibly go wrong?
Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. We were talking about this weekend and, your long swim over in the cold water here in Durango. You're preparing for the Alcatraz swim and your wife had your three other kids, but you had one of your sons with you. And you were saying, even if he never gets involved in triathlon, it's a way of him spending father-son time and really learning the culture.
Well, one of the things that we prioritize is time together. And so that could be in the kitchen cooking a meal. That could be sitting on the back porch and just sitting in two chairs next to each other as we read books that we both like.
Right.
Or, I'll run while they ride their bike and we can chat and kibitz as we go. And in this case, he wanted to bring a book, sit in the sun, play with a dog while I swam across the lake and back.
Well, and we were talking, you were discussing with your other son, who's 13, some of his ideas of what maybe he wants to study in college. And as I was looking back at, the raising of my kids, we got to talking about how you can try to set the trajectory for your child as much as possible. You spoke for the homeschooling conference last week and we talked about that. But it's really interesting how various events, various mentors and people who are interested in life can really change the trajectory of where we end up.
I've got one that wants to be an engineer in math and science is really his greatest passion. Another where I just can't stop him from reading. He's got a book in his hand all the time.
I can always ask him what he's reading.
At mealtime, I've got to, can you please put that down? Where other families, you might say, can you not bring your phone? I have to say, can you not bring your book? Or at least tell us what you're reading. 500 pages a week is a light week for him. He loves it. And I don't know if that means that he's geared for history or literature or politics or philosophy or economics. We have no idea, but definitely perhaps the softer sciences. So we explore the possible. And that's one of the things that I like about doing some of these races and things. I just want them to know what's possible and what the spectrum is. Because there's plenty of examples in our culture of what a couch potato looks like. And there's plenty of examples of an uneducated approach to living and voting and whatever. And I want them to know kind of full spectrum what is possible. And I don't have expectations of them to go to an Ivy League school or anything like that. But we do talk about the full range from community college to Oxford University and everything in between. What does it take to do this or to do that or to do this or to do that? Your choices matter. And the little choices they begin to make today add up, they aggregate into something that's very important. Even now, they're setting the trajectory for their legacies.
It's good to have a plan, even though that plan can change many times. Something happened to me this last Friday that I shared with you. It really was impressive to me. When I was in college, I started in music. I'm a trumpet player and switched over to business ultimately. And I remember my first economics class, my macroeconomics class, I opened the book and it said careers in economics. And I just laughed out loud. I thought, who in the world would want a career in economics? But it was possibly because I didn't really understand it. I had a class later, a money and banking class, that was taught by this unique, I love the sort of the unique, tall, lanky genius kind of personality. That's what this guy was like. His name was Dr. John Cochran. And he paced back and forth in front of the blackboard and he was rattling. He always had $5 or $6 worth of change in his pocket and he nervously would rattle the change and he'd put the ISLM curve up or whatever, but he was fascinated with economics and it was contagious.
It made you fascinated, interested, intrigued.
This is before I met your dad. I was in college and I was fascinated enough to ultimately interview for ICA and with your dad and meet a man named Howard Onstott who later became a free market mentor of mine. So I have to tell you that.
Fast forward to Friday.
Howard, we talked about in the commentary a couple of weeks ago, has been distributing to us books. Howard's in his 90s. He's known that those books, those cherished books that he's written in and put post-its in and notes to himself in. He wanted those to go to the right people. Well, there was a book that I hadn't pulled off the shelf. I just put it up when we got it, and I pulled it off, and sure enough, it was about the debates between Friedrich Hayek and John Maynard Keynes in the 1930s, but it was written by Dr. John Cochrane, and I looked at the front of the book, and it was signed by Dr. John Cochrane.
Your professor.
It was fascinating, but it really made me think about how trajectories change. At first, I laughed at careers in economics, and then I met someone who was interested. And, you know, we've always said to be interesting, you have to be interested.
Well, yeah, and so the things that we're interested in, sometimes they may seem odd, but they do tie together. Big data and AI, you know, you may say, well, what does that have to do with pricing of assets? Actually,
just
more than
everything.
You think, because yeah. In today's world of high-frequency trading and black box models, there's more influence in the markets behind the scenes on a programmed basis, and we're moving towards a period of time where the desired outcome is a programmed outcome. Hmm. It's a predicted outcome. It's a designed and planned outcome. And it's according to someone's algorithm and someone else's desire. It's fascinating because all of a sudden you see the confluence of public policy and computer science and psychology and market action and economics.
So, it brings to mind Bookstopper, a guest of ours and someone who you've gone out to see in New York.
Yeah, and it's in his book, The End of Theory, we had him on the program, what, maybe 2 years ago.
Right, right. And first time we had him a few years ago.
Yeah. That's right. We talked about The Demon of Our Own Design, and then his subsequent book after he worked on the Dodd-Frank legislation and spent about 6 years in D.C., he wrote the book The End of Theory. And it's this fascinating look at 21st century determinism.
Mm-hmm.
And you really have to kind of stop and think about that. But the end of theory is the end of human autonomy and freedom as we've known it. It really is the end of the free markets if you think about it. Now, could something go wrong with that? Oh, certainly.
Right.
But the designs are to control an outcome. And it reminds me again of a conversation I had with my 13-year-old who says, why am I reading so many books on utopias and dystopias these days? Part of that is because my wife is designing the curriculum that just happens to be the right age to be asking questions about systems and how they work and whether they work and whether a perfect system is possible, et cetera, et cetera. But this is a new version of the old issue of let's design ourselves a utopia. The end of theory is utopian thinking for the 21st century, and it ties to creating a determinism using big data and artificial intelligence.
You know, Dave, I recently took a course on complexity theory, and I would recommend if that's new to them, to go online and try to read a little bit about complexity science. It's very different than, you know, the old chaos or what have you. Complexity is actually a lot of simple systems acting autonomously, or so they think, and actually creating a larger whole. And you remember, Dave, we talked a couple of years ago how the plunge protection team, the government plunge protection team, set up an office in Chicago that was specifically designed to influence high-frequency trading. Now, that's what we're talking about. This is when you actually go to supposedly autonomous actors, but you're influencing or you're inputting into that to try to control the system.
Now, did you say specifically designed or suspiciously designed? Because there, you know, the idea that we can control markets, again, this is not a new concept. We're just using new tools to go after the same thing. And so, yeah, we look at the markets and begin to see some weaknesses. And where there are weaknesses, you see, again, state actors stepping in to try to smooth them out,
right,
to try to make it go away, to try to mute the signal that usually market actors would respond to. And so, you know, we see a tightening of financial conditions, and then all of a sudden announcements from various prominent people, and those algorithms get fed into the markets, and all of a sudden it's calm once again. So there's never the ability for things to get wild and woolly, and this is by design.
It seems like perception management and liquidity management are the two tools that they use continually. They try to manage perception by a Fed chairman or one of the Fed presidents saying something to balance what was thought before, or they just apply liquidity directly to what may turn into a crisis.
And they get liquidity to that specific spot that needs it, or, you know, where they're trying to sort of paint the number, so to say. You look at the semiconductors, for instance, and they're up 30-35% this year, and yet you've got significant declines in sales and increases in inventory. I mean, if you look at the fundamentals of the semiconductor industry in the last 90 to 120 days, you're talking about one of the worst time frames in two or three decades.
Yet they're up 30%.
And they're at all-time highs. Hmm. So again, to paint a number, to take liquidity and push it in a particular direction, what it does is it does influence the mass mind. And as long as you can continue to influence the mass mind, then the narrative, whatever you want that narrative to be, almost has like a supporting aspect. There's supporting characters that go towards the main features that you're trying to drive that narrative forward. It all makes sense. It's all working, and no one questions the veracity of it because it all seems to be on tune, in key, and moving forward in the direction that, well, in fact, it is designed to go.
You know, Jim Grant has written the Interest Rate Observer for years because he believes that bonds are probably a more clear way of looking at the market. Bonds right now are looking down the road and they don't necessarily like what they see.
Yeah, particularly in the treasury market, you begin to see some traffic into treasuries even while last week we had stocks hitting all-time highs. Now, you know, this week, of course, we've got a little bit of jitters, but is it related to trade? And of course, we'll have a tweet or an announcement or something that'll soften those conditions before too long. We also have this notion of sell in May and go away. Certainly on our side, starting the week on the tactical short, we're increasing our short position. We did Monday in advance of the market's weakness and volatility, looking at the myriad of indicators we did through the weekend. Because what we see is emerging market weakness, and that weakness at the periphery does tend to migrate to the core, even if that migration takes 6 or 9 months. We think we'll see it front and center here in the U.S. before too long.
You know, earlier, before we started recording, we were talking about how 2019 seems an awful lot like the summer of 69. You know, if you go back 50 years ago, that was the lunar landing, the United States landing on the moon. But we had other things going on at that same time. We had a speculative market. You actually had a market that was peaking out, didn't you? But you had this feeling that it would go on forever.
See, you think about the lunar landing. For me, it's not the lunar landing. It's the ditty that Bryan Adams wrote, summer of 69. Oh, and I look back now, that summer should last forever. And if I had the choice, yeah, I'd always want to be there. Those were the best days of my life.
It was the summer of 69.
But here's the fascinating thing. We quickly forget that what was happening in 69, you know, employment numbers, as of last week, hit new lows, 3.6%. We haven't seen this level in employment since the summer of 69, which is fascinating because that is the year after the stock market topped. A year earlier, so 1968, if you look at the economic figures, it's very fascinating because you had the stock market, which had been in motion, bull market since 49, and it rolled forward, big bull market up to 1968, and yet you still had economic indicators saying, hey, this is great, everything's great, summer of 69, I mean, it's like paradise, right? But the market had already turned, but no one was really aware of it. It was just the best days of our life.
Well, and I would say that some people were aware of it. Maybe not the market, but look what else happened in 69. The central banks were buying massive amounts of gold. They were cashing their dollars in for gold. Look at 2018, last year. 74% more gold purchased by central banks. We hadn't seen anything like that really since 69.
You're right. There was a massive shift then. There was a massive shift just last year, 2018, 50 yeah. years to the year.
So do you think this time is different?
No, I don't. And I think it really depends on how you frame that because, Kevin, I mean, you know, we had the book written back in 2011? I forget.
No, it was 9. You're talking about
Rogoff and Reinhardt.
Yeah.
This time is different. As you know, I love to read on the plane, and I was reading that on the way down to Argentina about 2012. This time is different was the title. It's a paper that I think is worth reading. And if you want to look it up, it's 50 pages, small commitment, but very important, I think, titled This Time is Different, But It Will End the Same. Now, there's a longer subtitle to that, but This Time is Different, But It'll End the Same. Concluding what we had discussed 2 years ago, actually with Richard Buchstaber, the conclusion of this paper just written here in the last month or so. And this is where, you know, we basically now have underappreciated bottlenecks in the marketplace. And that's been the result of the post-crisis legislation. He came back, came on our program, and was like, look, I think we fixed a lot with Dodd-Frank. And I think we also set the stage for the next crisis because we created these bottlenecks. We re-incentivized certain behaviors and disincentivized others. The net result is that there's fewer market makers. And that means there's going to be a real concern in terms of liquidity, greater liquidity constraints in a large market sell-off. So this paper looks back, just as Bookstabber did a few years ago with us. The authors of the paper look back at the growth in corporate credit as a place of real concentrated risk alongside sort of the mismatch of asset and liability structures.
I thought it was interesting. Richard Bookstabber's been very honest about his inputs into helping or hindering the markets. In 1987, he was involved and he says, yeah, my bad. I mean, if you remember when he said that, it was my bad. He said, I was one of the guys who was there trying to engineer safety in the 1987 market. And it turned out poorly. When he was part of the Dodd-Frank.
Like Chernobyl poorly.
Yeah. It was the worst crash
check.
Since 29.
Don't worry about it. We're just melting down here.
But when he wrote The End of Theory, he was saying the same thing. He said, yes, I was involved in some of the solutions, but we have to realize, and this goes back to complexity, we have to realize a lot of those solutions are probably going to create the next crisis.
Yeah. So in this paper, it's mostly a review of the system, financial system, not being able to handle the flows of liquidations. As investors, you know, started to concentrate positions in exchange-traded funds and mutual funds.
Do liquidations ever happen, Dave, anymore?
Well, these are products that work very well on the purchase side, but begin to have some structural issues, and you can see their flaws revealed if there's liquidations through those products. So again, it's the ETFs and mutual funds focused on fixed income, particularly corporate bonds, which imply liquidity, but in no way can guarantee liquidity because of the limitations of the structure.
Hotel itself. California. You can check in, but you can never leave.
Yeah. So the big picture is that there's no bids, there's no price discovery, and there's no exits. Those are the predictions made by the authors. No bids, no price discovery, and ultimately no exits from the products. And that, again, relates specifically to fixed income instruments within the ETF and mutual fund universes.
One of the things that Bookstabber brought up as a real problem is that because of the Volcker Rule, you don't have dealers necessarily incentivized to come in and soften the market. We've talked about market makers before, and you need dealers in the market so that when you don't have two parties, one selling and one buying, that know each other, you need a dealer who's going to be the interim step.
Yeah, the three authors of this paper look at the trend from 2013 to present, and the primary dealers are holding less and less bond inventory because, as Bookstabber pointed out, the incentives to do so have all but been eliminated.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So market makers, again, that's the buyer of last resort, or traditionally has been the buyer of last resort in the past, and they've been willing to increase their inventories when the market comes under pressure because they're paid fairly handsomely to do so. The Volcker Rule makes it difficult to distinguish between proprietary trading, where they're trading for their own account, and the market making function, where they're inventorying to resell to someone else. And so they've crushed the benefits for the market making because of the confusion over prop trading and market making. Prop trading has been frowned upon because, as we've seen with Goldman Sachs and other firms, they've traded in the best interest of the firm and taken the other side of the trade from their firm clients. So and the SEC has not smiled on that nicely. The government doesn't like it at all. The unintended consequence of a crackdown on prop trading is that no one wants to buy and hold inventories.
You know, you'll recall when we've had Jim Deeds on the program, he talked about when he first started his career, he walked into an office that had municipal bonds, not just a few municipal bonds, but stacks and stacks and stacks all through the office. Well, that was a market maker on municipal bonds. And this guy was basically saying, hey, there's no liquidity right now, but there's no way we're going to collapse this market either. So they were taking an inventory long enough to be able to clear those bonds out into a new buying community.
Well, and this is a feature within this paper. The trading of many fixed income instruments is OTC, which stands for over the counter, which further adds to the inefficiency and the opacity of the fixed income sector relative to stocks. Stocks trade very easily. They're a simple instrument to buy and sell. And there's just greater complexity, greater inefficiency within the corporate fixed income space. Real significant differences if you're comparing one versus the other. And in the OTC market, in the over-the-counter market, it's a slower process. And it really only works well in one direction.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, add to that that bonds have layers of complexity that stocks don't, because you're talking about liabilities. That structure is different than an equity, and it relates to some collateral, or, you know, it's backed by some asset of the company. So it's just a tougher thing to get your arms around altogether.
Yeah, we have really not seen in over 30 years a bond market that collapses and has no bids. I mean, we really haven't had that because we've had falling interest rates and, you know, demand for bonds.
Well, right. So 30 plus years of a bull market in bonds, this one-way flow of money into bonds, we don't even know what it looks like to have money flow out in earnest. So your bonds trade through relatively few institutional entities. So when the price of the asset is in question, those entities come into question. Go back, if you will, to Lehman. Lehman was really involved in the mortgage-backed securities market,
mm-hmm.
right? So they had huge exposures to MBS, mortgage-backed securities. And when there was questions about the value of the assets backing those loans, then the next question was, who's playing with those loans the most, and can we trust them? So like Lehman, with its outsized MBS exposure, when you have concerns emerge, that's where all of a sudden liquidity is no longer extended to those entities on concern that you might not get your money back.
Well, and again, you have several types of bond market. You have the government bond market.
Sure.
That's huge. We talk about that with deficits. You have the municipal bond market, which is cities and states, what have you. But the corporate bond market, you've been focusing on that. And, you know, if you think about it, it took from George Washington all the way to Obama, okay, to get to $9.2 trillion in U.S. debt. The corporate bond market is about that size right now.
Well, and it's doubled since the global financial crisis, just about doubled. So from 5 to 9, not quite, but $9.2 trillion is the corporate bond market today. And there simply is no entity large enough to backstop to support that market. Well, other than the Fed. So, you know, we talked about the market maker being the buyer of last resort. Well, that has shifted from market maker, corporate entity, what have you, private function, to the central bank, right? And that's the net result here, is that now the only entity capable with enough, you know, sort of room, if you will, on their balance sheet to step in and buy assets and support prices in the corporate bond sector, buying a trillion and a half, $2 trillion in debt.
And you think that might be purposeful?
It's the Fed, and perhaps it was intended. But, you know, that would be consistent with Buchstaber's argument in The End of Theory. I think it's a must read if you want to appreciate the 21st century command and control dynamics within the financial marketplace.
It's brilliantly written.
I will tell you, it's very thick and plan on reading it twice. It's not going to be obvious. It's definitely not, you know, light reading by any stretch. But it's worth looking at because this is how you engineer your 21st century command and control dynamics within the financial markets.
And it's not dry. I mean, he has a mixed interest level, and he knows how to tie things together.
Well, the paper also discusses kind of the cavalier approach to leverage ratios within the corporate environment. So scale is important. You've got that $9.2 trillion, but also the health of the issuer is important. And you've got many of these firms which, you know, have earnings of X, but now have, you know, debt of 5 and 6X relative to their earnings before interest, taxes, depreciation, amortization, before EBITDA, or relative to EBITDA. And the ratios are getting way out of whack. And so, again, this is not healthy. You've got a scale issue, but you also have a health issue in terms of these unhealthy ratios.
So you're saying that they're tending toward junk bond status.
It's, well, triple B today, in a market downturn, a lot of those triple B, barely investment grade bonds will quickly be recategorized as high yield. And, you know, high yield is the euphemism we use today for junk bonds.
Right.
It's what we called them
right.
yesterday. But, you know, what does that do? It causes major ripple effects into the junk bond space. For instance, I mean, so you've got junk bond prices, but what happens when the market supply of junk increases by 20 to 30% overnight? Well, it's easy. It's oversupply is solved by a quick reduction in price, and that's how you find demand, is price drops to a point where demand steps in, investors come in and buy at that particular price.
Well, let's talk about those investors, too, because we talk to an awful lot of people who are retired and cannot live on their interest. And so they've been forced either into the stock market or forced into the high yield market. But it's not just the individual investor. We're talking at this point, insurance companies and pension funds, people who would never touch a junk bond in the past have been forced because of interest commitments to go into markets that they would have never gone to before.
But this grand experiment with central planning through the central bank mechanisms controlling interest rates and through interest rates controlling prices has a very dark side. And that dark side is that investors don't realize how much risk they're taking as they're buying things like junk bonds. And it's very interesting that high yield has been so popular in recent years. Everyone is yield starved as a result of central bank negative or zero interest rate policies. And they're being forced to compromise the quality of the products they're purchasing, that is credit quality, to get the income that they require. So again, the grand experiment works until it doesn't. And I don't know who's going to be held accountable. I would love to place the blame squarely at the feet of the central bank community, who with great pride and hubris had said, no, we can, as masters of the universe, hold the sun, moon, and stars in place.
Well, we're not necessarily just talking about the largest corporations that are affected here. We're talking also, you know, companies that are sort of in the middle of things. They're having to also highly leverage their companies just to continue to keep up.
Right. So let's say you're borrowing less than $100 million. Your middle market companies, $50 million in borrowing, things like that. Your smaller borrowers, the leverage ratios are higher now for your middle market companies that are issuing bonds. Their leverage ratios are higher now on average than they were just before the financial crisis. So you've got the regulatory push post-global financial crisis, which had a positive impact on leverage ratios as it applied to the banks. Again, so regulatory push post-global financial crisis improves leverage ratios with banks, but merely pushes it around like so many peas on the plate, because it went somewhere else. So the leverage ratios are now out of whack in places like insurance companies and pension funds and private fund offerings, right? So the banks have kind of cleaned up their act. That sector is better looking than it was 2007 and 2008. But we've had massive credit expansion since then, and you don't have as much concentrated risk in those entities, which frankly makes it that much harder to bail out in the midst of a crisis, because, you know, now you're talking about a hodgepodge of, you know, $150 million there, $2 billion there, $7 billion there. I mean, it's all pocketed. And the declines are tougher to sort of say, well, we're just going to, like they did with Merrill and B of A, we're just going to do a little shotgun wedding here, and you guys are going to marry up and it'll be all right.
It's harder to isolate where the problem is when it's not just in the banks. I mean, we talk about shadow banking overseas. We have shadow banking here.
Well, that's right. And that's what has happened, is we've had the proliferation of credit. It's enabled credit expansion by other means. It's around the banks instead of through them. So your mutual funds, your ETFs, your hedge funds, they're a part of the shadow bank system that finances corporations. But these areas carry even more risk due to sort of the outright opacity.
Well, banks have reserve requirements.
Well, that's another factor.
A bank has to have a certain amount of money to loan a certain amount of money. These guys don't.
That's right. And the reserve requirements mean that you've always held something back. Right? You don't have to do that. Bank finance, as squirrely as it can get, it still requires cash to be reserved for volatility, cash to be reserved in the event of default on some of your loans. These other vehicles, we are talking about mutual funds, ETFs, hedge funds, they're unconstrained. And when something goes wrong, the transmission mechanism into the market, that weakness, it happens much quicker. There's not the same kind of liquidity reserves on hand.
You know, you talk about the summer of 69, but I can't help but also go back to 2007, 2008. We had acronym after acronym after acronym, and talk about opacity. It was hard, even when you were a professional in the industry, to keep up with the acronyms. But the acronyms, really, all they really represented was subprime.
Well, and all they were doing is taking one product and multiplying it or slicing and dicing it rather into tiers of other products and then saying, well, what piece of this puzzle, what piece of this whole do you want? The nature of a derivative is to take one product, slice it up into 10 products, charge 10 commissions instead of one. Wall Street loves that stuff, right?
And take three really bad investments, put it together and call it a AAA wonderful investment.
Yeah. So subprime still exists. Yes. When we had the nasty, toxic investments, you know, everything kind of cobbled together, what you're describing, but subprime still exists today. And it's popular in this cycle in the form of asset-backed securities.
ABS.
Instead of MBS, mortgage-backed securities. Mm-hmm. So asset-backed loans, a whole lot of which are now to the auto sector. And what you're seeing right now is the quality of asset-backed loans into the auto sector fast declining. So, and what are they doing? They want, the loans are being offered to more and more people who can't necessarily qualify them on the basis of a healthy FICO score because auto manufacturers need to move inventory. You've already got inventory with your big three auto between 83 and 90 days. Those inventory levels pretty high and they're motivated to move the product. Financing helps that. But again, you're financing on lower and lower FICO scores. What does that do? That expands the audience of potential buyers. And, you know, the beauty is for the dealer, you're rarely holding the paper.
Sure.
You don't care. As long as you're moving the product, let someone else
sell the loan right away.
Exactly. Yeah. Which is what banks were doing with mortgages. Originate that loan, get it out the door, off the books. It's not your risk exposure. All you wanted to do was take the 1% fee and move on down the road. And I think dealers are kind of doing the same thing, eliminating their risk, not holding the paper in house. So it moves to what? Credit unions. It gets stuffed into structured products where investors can buy, you know, a nice ABS package, have a diversified portfolio of crap. Again, the only concern is throughput. It's volume of transactions. How many vehicles are being sold just like the real estate market at the end of the cycle, right? So there's a recent deal put together, $154 million deal. Not a big deal, right? In the grand scheme of things, but 14% of the borrowers thrown into that pool structure had zero credit score. We're not right. talking like 500. They didn't have any credit history, and yet they're being given loans to buy new vehicles. 14% that went into the pot have no credit score. And you wonder how that ends?
Yeah.
And the reality is you already know.
And we know that the loans, a lot of them are not being paid. You know, it amazed me how many commercials I saw this last weekend by TitleMax. You know, get your title back with TitleMax. Well, somebody is paying to give the title back to the person. You know, high-risk loans. If that person wasn't able to pay the loan before, there's still a likelihood that they're not going to be able to pay the loan now. But it's extending the credit cycle, just like what we saw with the subprime loans back in 2007.
The two areas where we've seen massive amounts of debt growth, I mean, obviously, we've seen it in corporate debt. We talked about that earlier, $9.2 trillion. That's a big deal.
Yeah.
But the two areas where it seems like you'll see significant social change, one, you go into the student loan market, $1.5 trillion, up from $400 billion just a few years ago. And these are debts that are very difficult to pay. You're talking
sure.
about a generation that will have a difficult time saving for retirement, buying a first-time home. It's a major game changer unless there's some sort of debt relief there. And we've talked about that in recent weeks with Elizabeth Warren suggesting to buy your vote for $50,000. No, I mean, she didn't say buy your vote. She was going to forgive $50,000 of debt if you're not making $100,000 or more.
Who's not going to take that?
Buy your vote for $50,000.
Yeah.
But the other area, this auto loan segment, that has grown pretty rapidly to $1.2 trillion. And it has all the signs of lower quality and higher risk, which are associated with the end of a cycle.
Okay, so going back to 2006, because that was our last major crisis.
And you had subprime mortgages in that 2006 timeframe, were about 13% of the total, right? So just over $1 trillion. And, you know, the paper I mentioned earlier, what they discuss is obviously a change in credit quality and where you have growth in the lower tier quality as you move farther along in the process of the credit cycle. And they also talk about leveraged loans. We talked about leveraged loans a few weeks ago. Very low quality corporate credit. That now is over $2.2 trillion.
Hmm.
So again, you've got all these pockets of risk. By the way, the $2.2 trillion that's low quality corporate, what they call leveraged loans. Guess what percentage of that leveraged loan segment is covenant light?
Well, you said 2006 was 13%, right?
80% of this leveraged loan market is covenant light. In other words, if you can fog a mirror, they'll give you money.
Wow.
It doesn't take much. And again, covenant
light. We never learn from history.
No. Well, that's just it. What do we learn from history?
Right. Right.
That we learn little from history. I mean, so that's the reality is we're doing this all over again. We're just doing it in other places. It's not in the mortgage-backed securities market this time. It's in the asset-backed securities market. It's in a variety of corporate sectors.
But give it a three-letter acronym. Give it a three-letter acronym, and it can exist, and it can be called good paper.
I'm just surprised that they haven't come up with an acronym for a financial product that is like sexy, S-E-X-Y. Like, don't you want to buy that? Like, it's just they come very close. They make it attractive. They make it, you know, it's a euphemism. Everything is good. High yield. Isn't that better than junk?
Mm.
Who wants junk when you can have high yield? It's what you need, isn't it?
So the name of this paper is This Time is Different, Only It's Not, right?
Only It's Not. Right. So they look at the proliferation in that paper of CDOs and CLOs, the structured products, the derivative products, which contributed to a lot of the uncertainty and obviously a lot of the pain that we went through during the global financial crisis. There was a footnote on page 27, which I really liked. It was discussing a February 2018 U.S. Court of Appeals case, and it was ruling in favor of a CLO fund manager. And they basically said you no longer have to comply with risk retention rules. So the skin in the game rules designed to align between, you know, they want to align the interest between the structured product manager and the potential investor. According to this 2018 February, you no longer have to have skin in the game. Again, well, didn't we learn something from the 2008-2009 timeframe?
But if you know you're going to get bailed out, I mean, the words for that are moral hazard, moral hazard. You create a moral hazard when someone can gain from taking a risk, but know that they don't have to lose if the risk goes badly.
So we're back to packaging garbage, selling it on to unsuspecting investors. Or they're not unsuspecting. They're investors that the Fed has forced out of bank CDs, earning a relatively safe 5% into junk bonds, yielding 5%. And who's to blame? I mean, on the one hand, you have very clever and unscrupulous product creators on Wall Street. But the reality is they're operating within legal limits. We go back to that 2018 ruling. They're not breaking the law if they don't have skin in the game.
Well, that's what was happening back in 2006 and 7. People were not breaking the law because the laws allowed them to do it.
And so the problem is a legislative problem. There is a strange morphology within the public sphere where, you know, they're out to help the common man. On the other hand, it's just not the way it rolls most of the time.
Right. But wouldn't you blame the central bankers as well? Because they back up everything.
I would tend to, yeah, because again, as clever and as unscrupulous as Wall Street can be, they tend to operate within the legal limits.
Mm-hmm.
But on the other hand, you have central bankers that know the history of credit. They know the history of credit excess, and they're still playing fast and loose with their utopian ideas of perpetual growth.
This goes back to utopia, what your son is studying.
Yeah, so here they are. The central bank community is flogging the asset markets to extract their dreams and establish their place in history as sort of setting a new standard for growth and prosperity. But on my short list for the tarring and feathering, they all have PhDs, they're all in economics, and the reality is history, I don't think, will treat them kindly because their deeds are not as benign as they want to believe they are. So the bottom line from this paper is that there are structural limitations and flaws within a sector that continues to grow. That sector continues to grow and thereby increase total systemic risk.
You know, we've talked about World War II being just an extension of an unfinished war called World War I. In a way, I look at 2006, 7, 8, 9. That crisis never really ended. We just painted over it, and we painted over it with a lot of liquidity. It looks to me like we're doing exactly the same thing, just putting together a bunch of horrible investments, calling them by a different name, and then putting them into what people would trust for their pension or their retirement.
Have you ever known someone who had a black mold issue in their house? The smartest thing that they can do is start over.
Mm.
Just strip it out, go down to the studs. You've got to bleach it, disinfect it, get it all out. And so the drywall comes out. I mean, you go down to the studs. Your furniture is gone. Your clothes are gone. A real black mold issue, you got to go back to the very basics, right? There has to be a total cleansing. In this case, all we did is we discovered black mold 2006, 2007.
And we painted over it.
Well, or put new drywall on top of the old drywall and paint it over that, and it looks great. The reality is it's there. It's always been there. It's never gone away. We never resolved the issue. It's just waiting to be revealed yet again. Stephanie Pomboy, listen to her comments occasionally, read her comments occasionally, and she was quoted in Barron's earlier this year. She says, in 2007, the lie was that you could take a cornucopia of crab, package it together, and somehow make it AAA.
Mm-hmm.
This time, the lie is that you can take a bunch of bonds that trade by appointment, in other words, there's no liquidity, lump them together in an ETF, and magically make them liquid. The upshot is that these vehicles are only liquid in one direction.
Hmm. And that's what I'm saying, Dave. I don't think people believe you have to liquidate anything anymore. All we've had is passive investing here this last few years, where people are just putting money in. There was no need to liquidate because the central banks had everybody's back.
And the central banks will continue to try to have everyone's back. The question is if they can keep the psychology of the market pinned and held together, because that is their attempt. Their attempt is to control the mass mind, whether it's through propaganda, whether it's through algorithms, any way that they can. But you have the same issue in mutual funds as you have in ETFs.
Yeah, you said that was the shadow banking.
Right.
It's where you have mutual funds, ETFs. Everybody's jumping in on this.
And from 2008 to the present, you've had the same trend where your allocation to corporate fixed income within the mutual fund complex, it was a 7% allocation then. It's now a 15% allocation today. That's $2 trillion in corporate bonds sitting in mutual funds, and they've got similar liquidity constraints to your ETFs. Now, that didn't used to be. We've mentioned this in recent months where mutual fund managers are being pressured by the owners of those mutual funds to eliminate the cash component within the mutual fund because it causes them to underperform whatever index they're being compared to. And when they underperform, you see money flow out. Okay, so that's you've got $2 trillion in corporate bonds in the mutual fund space. Ordinarily, you'd have a little bit of liquidity cushion, but that's going away too. The retail investor believes that he or she has same-day liquidity, or even better, instant liquidity with an ETF.
Sure.
Do you see the mismatch that Stephanie's talking about? Where you believe that you have liquidity, but if you sell along with three other people, all of a sudden, three people can't fit through the door.
One of these things that the complexity class taught me was that you've got to be careful how you set the goals. If you're trying to manage something, make sure you don't set the goal that'll create a problem larger than the one you're trying to avoid. And, you know, I look at what you're talking about with mutual funds. The goal now has just been to keep up. You know, it's whoever can run the race the fastest. So there's no need for liquidity. But look at another goal. If the goal for the corporate sector is to have earnings, higher earnings, and raise the share price at the same time, all you have to do is borrow money and buy back the shares.
Well, you know, think about the business that we own or any other private business out there. You manage the business not for what is the company worth today. What is the company worth today? And every day ask the same question. What is the company worth today? It doesn't matter. I'm not selling. It doesn't matter what the company is worth. I'm managing an enterprise for the next 2-3 decades, and I make decisions to invest according to a 2-3 decade timeline, mm-hmm. right? So what becomes disturbing and where you have perverse incentives enter corporate America is where people actually care about how they are marked to market on a daily basis. What's my share price doing today? So if you look at the expansion of corporate debt, back to this $9.2 trillion number, it moves in very close correlation to your stock buybacks.
No, isn't that suspicious? So they're borrowing money to buy stocks.
Companies are exchanging debt for equity. It's mm-hmm. driving share prices higher. Executives are exiting their stock option plans at higher share prices, and they game the earnings per share game, creating the perception of an improved company. There are, I think, a number of unforgivable things here, because nothing new here. If you've listened to the commentary for any time, you know that these are pet peeves. The earnings that are being reported, this is the first thing you have to recognize. This is totally perverse. the earnings being reported are no longer compliant with the general accepting accounting principles. Mm. Right? So when you see earnings reports, understand that you don't have the full story.
It's non-GAAP.
It's non-GAAP. It's non-compliant with the general accepting accounting principles. And the SEC has determined that that's okay. It obscures just how overvalued most companies are. So, you know, Fred Hickey points this out recently, that if you look at the median stock price, compare it to sales, the ratio of sales to the price of those shares is 2 times what it was in the year 2000 as the stock bubble was topping.
That was the dot-com.
Right. So the most expensive market we've ever seen, and price to sales, we're 2 times that today.
Wow.
Right? So, but you will never see that in the PEs, because the PEs you're looking at are non-GAAP versus GAAP. If you looked at GAAP earnings, your earnings are going to be significantly less, and your earnings ratio is going to be significantly higher. So you see it elsewhere, this issue of overvaluation in stocks, if you have eyes to see it.
Okay, so you said there were 4 unforgivables. Yep, the first one is the earnings that are being reported.
Earnings being reported are not compliant with GAAP. Then the second one would be earnings on a per share basis continue to improve, in part by reducing the denominator in the earnings per share equation. And this is just basic math again, but you're comparing the earnings of a company to the share price of the company, right?
Okay, so let me get this. All right, the first one is that they're not even having to report according to general accounting principles. The second one is that they're reducing the amount of shares, like we talked about before, and creating an earnings per share boost that's not real.
Well, that's right. That's right. So they shrink the shares outstanding, and the earnings on a per share basis goes up. Mm. So your earnings divided by a fewer number of shares, that's how it's improving. Right. So these are games that have been played very consistently for the last 5 or 10 years. Share buybacks go back to the early 80s. So this is not entirely new, but where you see this massive increase in debt in exchange for shares, this is what's getting nasty, where they're adulterating their balance sheet in order to game the earnings per share numbers and look better than they are. So think about this. Think about this. Apple. Apple loses market share in the last quarter. So their smartphone market share drops from 15.7% of all market share in the smartphone category to 11.7%. Should the shares go up or down? Well,
right.
They went up,
they
of course.
Down. Well, they should go down.
But they went up, of course.
Right.
Their sales overall declined by 5%. Their iPhone revenues fell by 17%.
So what do? You buy back shares.
You buy back $75 billion worth of shares, and your shares go up again. Because the facts of the company having a decline in sales and revenue doesn't matter as long as you're changing the denominator, right? So Q1 earnings beat expectations, right? And most investors have the memory of a gnat, because Apple was radically reducing their Q1 expectations on earnings, lowered the bar, made it that much easier to get over it, right? So they beat expectations. They met expectations after lowering them, right? Yet they lower the bar, makes it easier to get over. Nobody seems to care that year over year, their operating income was down 16% in the first quarter.
You know, when you went to Scotland, you sat and talked to Smithers. And one of Smithers' main obsessions was that this was absolutely wrong, because the executives who are part of those corporations, they have stock programs. And what are they going to do? They're going to sell those stocks every time they kick those earnings up.
Right.
And they put their company in debt doing it.
Well, this is the third unforgivable, in my opinion. And you're right. Smithers was keen on making sure that remuneration committees were held to account for creating these misalignments in terms of incentives. You can get the managers of a business directing the capital of that business in a way that benefits them personally as executives and costs the shareholder, costs the owner of the business, and benefits the manager.
No, they wouldn't do that. Greed doesn't really exist, does it, Dave?
Well, it's a figment, right? So, but this is the third unforgivable in my mind. Share prices go up, and executives and insiders are selling their shares aggressively. And this is what strikes me as odd. Doesn't this strike you as odd? You use capital from the company treasury to repurchase shares and even create a liability on the balance sheet to repurchase shares. And you do that at elevated prices. And at those elevated prices, you sell what belongs to you.
Okay. Take a little profit.
Okay, so this is not a problem with capitalism. And this is what I'm afraid as we move towards the 2020 election. You know, capitalism gets thrown under the bus for stuff like this. This is not a failure of capitalism. This is human greed. Mm-hmm. This is self-interest. These factors are old as dirt, and we've allowed for these sort of loopholes to find expression, right? So you've got remuneration committees who aren't doing their jobs. This is an issue of corporate governance,
right?
This is not a failure of capitalism. This is a failure within the context of corporate governance. Since the global financial crisis, we're talking about trillions of dollars extracted from corporate entities. At the same time, trillions of dollars in new debt has been added to those corporate entities, to those balance sheets. It's the future of the company, which seems to pale in contrast to the present value benefit those companies are providing for managers, right? This is a crisis of corporate governance.
Right.
It's a conflict of interest between the owners, that is the shareholders, and the managers. They're way out of alignment.
Dave, you have rules here in the company that we all have to follow. And many of the things that we do have to be approved by a committee before we can do it with a client, what have you. It's interesting that corporations don't demand. Why wouldn't shareholders demand that their executives be held accountable for this type of behavior?
So if you're on a board and you're on the remuneration committee, you don't have to be invited back to the board next year. Right. So there's this issue of, you know, are you going to be invited back? Are we going to vote you in again? And are we going to even put your name in the hopper to be reelected as a board member? There's a lot of pressure that comes from being against the existing executive committee, the existing C-suite.
Right.
And, you know, maybe I jumped the gun on that last point because number four, I would say balance sheet destabilization is the fourth unforgivable. Adding
purposely.
Oh, yeah. When you're adding lots of debt. Okay, so you've got rates that are low, and a part of that looks genius because you're financing operations at a very low cost of capital. But I think one of the things that ignores is the fact that those debts are with you for the long haul. The prices or the interest rates associated with them do change through time. So you've got balance sheet management in corporate America that suggests to me that the attitude in the C-suite, your executive suite, is a little bit cavalier in terms of its approach to the future. And again, I'm all for financing on long terms at cheap rates, but it still has to be on projects that have a positive rate of return. You can't do it on things that have no rate of return or just, again, there to sort of dissolve shares outstanding.
You know, I think people's resolve, though, as far as the real market ever kicking in, all these things are fine, what you and I are talking about. And you and I know, through many years of doing this, that cycles repeat. But I've had several conversations, one just this morning in a meeting, where a person who should know better just basically is saying, why should we worry about a downturn? I mean, the banks have got it. Why would you be needed in these markets if you're defensive in your position?
Yeah. Well, you know, Barron's last month runs the front cover with a giant bull on the front. This is April. And the title of the lead article reads, "Is the bull unstoppable?"
That's the question people have in their mind.
Yeah. You know, and then the subtitle for that was, "The decade-long rally could continue for years," the optimists say. And it reminds me of what happened at Barron's. This was a Barron's article in April. And it reminds me of what happened at Barron's after 10 years of a bull market in gold, right? They tend to extrapolate, get very bold when they could actually be getting cautious. So you've got 10 years of gold prices increasing an average of 12% a year. Barron's runs a lead story on why gold is the most important asset for investors to own, can't do without it. And honestly, that was a signal. When Barron's gets confident about anything and is unabashedly, hey, this is the direction to go, you should be cautious. They are a great contraindicator.
It might have been a good time to take a profit back in 2011 when Barron's did that. Well, I think maybe we missed that.
Absolutely we did. But you have Europe in the throes of crisis in 2011, and I ignored the signal because we're watching the European monetary unit collapse in front of us,
right.
And it's very difficult to let go of gold when you look at a project that goes back to the 1950s, and it is in the context of existential demise.
Well, and you have to remember, too, Draghi in August of 2011 came out, and he basically spoke for all the central bankers of the world, we will do whatever it takes.
Right.
And that was something that I think was unpredictable. But you're right. Barron's, let's remember the Barron's signal next time. Could we do that?
Bloomberg writes last month, that inflation is dead, right? And the caption and the question is next to a dinosaur carcass. Okay, so we have no worries about inflation. The bull market and stocks will go on forever. You've got another Bloomberg article which asks, did capitalism kill inflation?
Hmm.
Okay, so again, inflation is dead. Capitalism wins. Inflation is no longer a worry. Late April, also from Bloomberg, the print reads, history's longest bull market gets a new lease on life.
Hmm.
And then Barron's again, here in an article just in the last week, an article reads, this bull market has no expiration date.
I told you about Fortune magazine in 1987 when I first started here. In the summer of 87, when the market was just screaming, looked like it could go on forever, Fortune magazine said, is the market too high? And it said, expectations say it could go on for many more years.
This bull market has no expiration date.
Mm.
So much of what we're talking about is sentiment. And being able to maintain positive sentiment is really what the central banks are trying to do. That's what they're trying. When you think about market intervention, they don't care about prices. They care about people, because people end up determining the ultimate direction of prices.
Well, and if you're trying to sell a hedge fund or a mutual fund, you've got to go with the crowd.
Today, we've got hedge funds jumping on the bandwagon with enthusiasm, taking out the largest short position on volatility ever recorded.
No, so they're saying it's going to stay stable.
Right. So, and again, VIX is a measure of volatility. They're betting that the VIX index, that price, will go down, indicating that all is well in the stock market. There is nothing to be worried about. On the horizon, we see no concerns or increase in volatility. They're betting on the death of volatility.
Mm.
The largest hedge fund bet against volatility is in the market right now.
Wow.
And it's ironic that that bet follows the best quarterly performance in decades. Feelings are the issue. Feelings are the issue, and circumstances are what drive them. Greed is a natural expression, as is overconfidence, in an environment where you've just experienced success. What have we had? Success. What does that breed? A feeling of ebullience.
Well,
right?
There is no fear in the market. There's no fear, like I was saying, the conversations that I'm having with people who are outside of our purview, you know, as a business, the man on the street, they're like, what are you talking about? Why would the market come down?
That's right. So the bond market investor today has no fears of default. And again, maybe you've got a few investors scrambling for treasuries because they don't like what they see by the time we get to the end of the year. But the bond investor in general, who's coming into corporate credit, who's coming into high yield bonds, they have no fear of default. They have no fears of inflation because
right.
They read it and they believe it. Capitalism has killed inflation, and we associate inflation as being a dinosaur carcass, long dead, now irrelevant, no longer a part of the equation.
Even the Federal Reserve is coming out and saying, gosh, we just don't have enough inflation.
Right. So the stock market investor has the twin supports of the Trump Twitter posts. Obviously, he's doing everything that he can to prop up the market. He loves the stock market. You've got central bank resolve, the other buttress, if you will, and they've said, we're going to keep the game going forever. Go back to where we started the conversation today, Kevin. The end of theory is a book. It's also a playbook.
Hmm.
Okay. The end of theory is a playbook. It's a picture into the world of big data and AI, artificial intelligence, and the ways in which investor sentiment can be led and prodded like a bull with a ring in its nose. In your conscious or unconscious mind, you feel ebullient forever, and the market behaves a certain way forever. The market has been bested. The expansion of credit will drive prices to infinity. This is the world that the central bankers are working with.
You've got to keep the story going.
Right. And so what are we talking about, really? We're talking about propaganda. We're talking about psychology. We're talking about control of the mass mind via big data and AI. Because if you can harness artificial intelligence and big data, if you can control the algorithms, you're on the way to creating 21st century determinism. And that, more than anything, is what Buchstaber was being a proponent of in his book, The End of Theory. 21st century determinism. The project is in motion. The question is, what could possibly go wrong?
You've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. Now, I'm Kevin Orrick, along with David McIlvaney. You can find us at McIlvaney.com, McIlvaney.com, and you can call us at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.